Tyler Parker from The Ringer joins me to discuss Coby White and the argument for patience, Shea Gilgis Alexander's unlimited expectations, and the comedy genius of What About Scarves? All that and more is coming up right now on this episode of Divine Intervention. Upwards to the vanguard, where the pressure is so high, under the microscope, hope against hope. John Gennaro, count me in!
One, two, three.
Today's first words belong to The Flaming Lips, Oklahoma City's own, from Race for the Prize off their 1999 LP, The Soft Bulletin, but the rest of them belong to me. Welcome to Divine Intervention, a self-help podcast about basketball. My name is Dan Devine, and before we get started, here are three things I am grateful for today. Number one, I get paid by Yahoo Sports to write about the NBA and talk about it into this microphone and into that camera. Pretty good deal. Number two, we actually got some snow here in Brooklyn, New York, after something like 700 days without an inch of it, which means alternate side parking is suspended for today, which means I don't have to move my car this morning, which means right now, currently, I feel dominant and ungovernable. And number three, just as important as all of that, I get to spend part of my morning with perhaps the most electrifying man in sports writing entertainment today. My guest is a tremendous writer whose work I first encountered more than a decade ago at Ballerball, a sports blog dedicated to the tripartite premise that basketball is fun, basketball is funny, and basketball tells a story. Pretty good premise. These days, he's a staff writer at The Ringer, where he has given us mind-melting prose about topics including but not limited to the art of passing, the defense of OG Anunoby, the power of Garth Brooks, and the comedy of Joe Parra. He is also the author of a novel called A Little Blood and Dancing, BAM, which hit bookstores, libraries, and e-readers and audiobook purveyors last summer and is next up on my nightstand. I promise I'm getting there next. Most relevant for our purposes today, he is a native of the great state of Oklahoma who has long harbored great affection for and paid close attention to the Oklahoma City Thunder. Friends, a warm welcome for Tyler Parker. Tyler, thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
Dude, Dan, I mean, John was not lying. I'm going to clip that out and like use that as my resume. That's incredible. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. That's all wildly undeserved, but you're so sweet for saying it. And I'm stoked. I'm stoked to be here. Upwards to the vanguard. A Ballerball mention is blowing my mind, truly.
Well, one of the benefits of having been doing this for a while is that you've aged into the place where you actually remember a bunch of shit. So it's like right. Like when Michael Pina, also of The Ringer, when he was on, I was like, yeah, I remember reading your WordPress blog, Shaky Ankles, and his eyes got saucer wide. Like, yeah. Oh my God, before we even were doing this as jobs.
I remember writing like four pieces a week for that Ballerball thing, like waking up like at like 5:30 before work and cranking out just some undoubtedly god awful bullshit about like Tyreek Evans or something. And yeah, that cuts in the cage, man. Cuts in the cage. But yeah, that's blast from the past. Thank you for that.
My pleasure. Also, the under the aegis of our friend Jason Gallagher.
Jason Gallagher.
Talk about upwards to the vanguard. I mean, like running the JJ Redick media empire out here. But many years ago, many moons. But I have asked you here today, Tyler, not only to talk about Ballerball, but because when crafting topics for upcoming shows, super producer John Gennaro and I settled on the following complicated and nuanced notion. Holy shit, the Thunder! And given some of the wonderful things that you have written about the team and its players over the years and how hard you lean into the fun of all of this stuff, I could think of nobody else that I'd rather discuss all of it with than you. And we will get there. We're about to get there. But first, here on Divine Intervention, we always try to operate from a place of joy. So, Tyler Parker, what is something from the world of basketball that has been giving you joy this week?
So, I'm going to go Coby White. And I don't know, I don't know if it's if there's too much Coby White in the world right now and it's just going to fall on deaf ears, but there like I can't get enough. And the way that he has completely elevated things in Chicago just from an aesthetics perspective, honestly, like just purely as like, oh, the Bulls are on. This might actually be kind of fun.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like he's had a couple handfuls of plays that stand out. I mean, the two that for whatever reason are in my head right now, he had a play against the Rockets where he got Sengun ISO'd on him and just like basically like gave him the full menu of like handle and went by him and hits Caruso for a three in the corner. And it was just one of those, like, increasingly, like, with every crossover, the Bulls announcers are getting more and more unhinged, you know? And, like, you feel Stacey King, like, undoing the top button on his shirt, like, you know, as he's going by Sengun. It was fantastic. And then, I mean, there was a run in the first half against the Warriors the other night and that loss they had to the Warriors, but it culminated in right before the half, he hits a, you know, Steph-ish 30-footer at the buzzer. And it kind of weirdly felt like a moment. Like watching it sort of, you're just like, man, it's really Kobe White time right now. You know what I mean? Like this is moving beyond kind of a little blip in the NBA sphere. Like he's put together a little run here that's been extremely consistent and fun. And I'm stoked.
First of all, I love that you preface this by saying there might be too much Kobe White out there. Like, this is perhaps indications of bubbles that we live in the world. Like, I guarantee you, if you went up to anybody else in the world and was like, is there too much Kobe White out there for you right now? Then you go like, who are you talking about?
That's a good point. Yeah, you're right. Yes.
But you're absolutely right. Like, this went from a story that was, okay, Zach LaVine's out, so somebody else is going to have to cook a little bit, to like, no, you need to now figure out in what, like, how things work around Kobe White for this Bulls team. Like, since the beginning of December, he's at like 22.5 points, 6 rebounds, 6 assists. He's shooting 42% from three. And as you said, like, on increasingly more audacious shots and like the kind of playmaking selection befitting his just sort of general, you know, joie de vivre, like the vibe of his play.
Yeah,
and you're
okay,
well, if you can do that on volume with everything continuing to kind of feel good, then yeah, maybe you're not just like, well, we can't figure out what to do with that guy and he's the sixth man. And maybe he's just like a fun sideline. Like, maybe you actually have to figure out how to build things around him, which further complicates every complicated thing already in terms of how the Bulls navigate their backcourt. But that's like a bigger picture idea. The general point of, we find sources of joy and like surprise from surprising places all over the NBA every night. That's kind of what you have to do to keep doing this on a night to night basis for, you know, year after year. And Kobe White going from like, I don't know if that guy's ever going to make it, to he is cooking like all stars out in space on the regular, is kind of a wild and wonderful one.
It's great. I think it's going to like, or hopefully it makes, you know, like us, people like us, fans, more patient with some of these dudes going forward.
Great point.
Where it's like, you're not so quick to call a dude, because nobody would have called White a bust or anything like that. But you would have also said, oh, maybe he has not yet had the career that we would have hoped for taking him that high. Right. But to see him able to turn into this at this point, so many years into his career, it does just sort of make you think like, okay, like what are other guys that right now, either because of dudes ahead of him in the lineup or just, you know, like the stars haven't aligned right yet, who's an injury away from taking this kind of leap themselves? It's I found that as he continued to have success, it just sort of started to make me go like, well, what if they had traded him? And then this just, he blossoms somewhere else, you know,
right.
And then it's been so fun to watch him get to initiate so often. And that since LaVine has come back, it's nice that the White Renaissance has not stopped. You know what I mean? There hasn't been like some like, oh, okay, like let's get back to normal here. You know?
Right. The only thing I'm going to ask for us to clip out of that is the White Renaissance. And we're going to hang on to that and just use that as a stinger you know, I don't know. Every time I make a particularly good point, I'm not sure. We're not sure what we're going to use it for, but we're going to, it's going to be important.
Right.
But also, yeah, to your broader point, like, I know, because I've been guilty of that where I'm like, I don't know. It's like Kobe White's 4 years in and like he's been like a decent bench. I don't know. He's 23 years old. Like, if the world had given up on many of us at 23 years old, you know, would not be bringing you this delightful content today. I love that. Kobe White. This is the longest we've talked about Kobe White, but there's too much Kobe White out there. So we're going to have to cut it short there. Tyler, I brought you here today to talk about the Thunder. Before we get into this year's model, which is fascinating and wonderful, and I want to discuss at length, I want to go back a little bit, kind of try to trace the arc of how we get here. Right. So, like, Oklahoma City becomes an NBA city, an NBA place, like 2005, 2006, Hurricane Katrina displaces the Hornets and need a place to play, and like parts of two seasons there. It's like, oh, this could work. Like there's a sports loving fan base there, obviously from Oklahoma State and the Oklahoma Sooners. And there, you know, there's a ready-made audience there. Maybe this could really be an NBA market, which then sadly leads to the zero sum game of Clay Bennett brings the Sonics to Oklahoma City in 2008. And at that point, you're, you know, a young sports fan in Oklahoma. I'm just wondering, like, what do you remember about sort of the transition to Oklahoma City being like an NBA place? Like, oh, shit, we actually are an NBA place.
I remember just like, it was really just pure excitement, honestly. Like there was when the Hornets were around, like, I mean, I grew up like far from the city, like mm-hmm. 2.5-3 hours away. And so it wasn't like a regularity to go up there or anything, but I specifically remember going with a bunch of school friends to go watch a Mavericks Hornets game, and we sat on the very top row because those were the seats that we could afford. And I just remember thinking, like, this is unbelievable that there's an NBA team down there on the floor, like that Dirk came here to our town.
Right,
this is crazy. And then when the Thunder got there, I remember not caring at all how bad they were and being excited that there were some like young dudes already there that had shown enough that you could be pumped up about the possibility of, you know, you didn't know. I don't think anybody thought, oh, they'll be in the, you know, NBA finals in 4 years or
right.
But there was like a, oh, there's, we have Durant here when Russ arrived. Okay, we've got these two guys who are worth following, and like clearly there's something here, varying degrees of it, especially early on. You didn't know that Russ was going to get to what he became. And Durant from jump, you know, you were just sort of like, oh, okay, like I see how this works. Like I see how this ramps up into something, you know, really scary. And so, yeah, it was just pure elation. And just you were so excited that like something that previously felt like something you would have to like go on vacation to do, right, to go see an NBA yeah. game. You know what I mean? Is now, oh shit. Like, you know, I went to college like 30 minutes outside of the city. And every now and again, you could go in and watch a game. You know, it was fun to be able to go and see Kobe if he was into, you know, like that was an option just as an entertainment in general. You were just like, this is insane. I can't believe it's also like, oh, wow, these games are just on cable. I can just watch these games.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like I couldn't afford League Pass at the time. And so I was like keeping up with the league, like probably a lot of other people, just nationally televised games, some illegal streams here and there. Right. And then like you're looking at box scores the next day. And, I remember sitting there in college and watching games just on like, you know, Tuesdays and Wednesday nights with my buddies, and thinking like, this is incredible that we have NBA programming just on our cable here. I remember thinking specifically that was just a top flight entertainment for me.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, it's, you know, to transition from like the best damn sports show period or whatever to like, oh, there's like a live actual game happening on this network. It's pretty great.
Well, and like something that is typically like, you're going to watch like, I think it was the Fox Sports Network. Like, you're going to watch like OU Texas Tech, like baseball or something before that, right, or whatever. Like, you know what I mean? Like the programming wasn't exactly sterling. And so it, once Earl Watson got to town, things really started looking up, you know?
Well, Earl Watson, of course, yeah, he's sort of the John the Baptist figure that we've all talked about a lot, bringing the good news of what was to come into town. But yeah, from there, you know, the Thunder become, you know, not just the team on the local package, they become the team you've got to program on the national games because they're so friggin' good. You know, they bring the pre-existing core, you know, Kevin Durant from the Sonics, and then that first draft of like Russell Westbrook and Serge Ibaka, 2009, James Harden comes, and you got like, this, it's all happening. It's all here. And from there, as you mentioned, the stations of the NBA cross, right? Like 50 win season, you play the Lakers in the first round, you lose to them, but you put up a good showing. They go on to win the title. 55 win season, get to the conference finals, lose to the Mavs, good showing. They go on to win the title. Play at like a 58 or 59 win pace in the lockout season, make it to the finals, you know, lose to the Heat, they win the title. But you're like, you're seeing this, the growth in real time, and you're seeing the investment and the faith you put into these young players sort of all blossom. And, you know, we know where it goes from there. And, but like, when you think back on that time, like before it starts to unwind and things start to change so much, like, I know you're somebody who thinks so much about being like the joy and the playfulness of it all. Like, what was it like to watch that young core kind of grow?
Now it's much easier to remember the good times than it is the like little ones. Like if you had asked me in 2017, I would have had a very quick laundry list for you of the ways that things went wrong. And I'm sure if we talked long enough here, I could get back to the list, but the thing that I remember the most about them was sort of how overwhelming the athleticism could be whenever they would every now and again, get into one of those like Surge at the Five kind of lineups. And you would see this, I mean, when Harden was still there, but even after Harden left, like some of those Russ and KD teams, whenever they would get in transition and they were getting out in passing lanes and getting deflections, and when the defense was like on point and the screws were tight, they could get out in transition so quickly and things could avalanche on the other team so fast that it was, as a fan, like those moments of, oh, we're on a run, and oh, wait, it's just not stopping. You know what right. I mean? Like I remember in those, that first Lakers series in 2010, in those games 3 and 4, there were different points where the crowd was so loud. I was watching those games on TV, but the crowd was so loud and it was so unexpected that the Thunder were not just giving the Lakers like a tough matchup, but also like running them off the floor in these two games. I just remember feeling so much like so happy and not even understanding how it's happening. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like at that point, there were still so many flaws with the team, and really throughout the time that the Thunder, you know, were a big time contender, there were always flaws, right? There was like shooting was always an issue. Sometimes late game offense could get really crunchy and into the grind and predictable. And there's all the Kendrick Perkins lineup snafus and everything else, right? Like all that stuff where you're just like, why won't we just put Durant at the five? What are we doing? Or like, you know,
right.
Like all the little fan stuff where you're just imagining like maybe Sam will get tired of Scott Brooks this year, Oh no, we got enough. Okay, he's got still got a little more rope left on the leash. All right, but I'm sorry, I'm rambling. I remember thinking, I can't believe that they're this good already, and it does start to like rejigger your brain a little bit in terms of, oh, I thought that we were further away. You know what I mean? And so it's like that kind of, it's that fun moment. Like, I love the Stations of the NBA Cross is a fantastic turn of phrase by you. And like that, I love the idea of like you're watching this and then you're thinking like, oh, wait, am I going to be a fan of a team that's actually really, really good now? You know what I mean? Like you're trying to battle there's the fan side of you that always has rose colored glasses on. That's, I'm always trying to battle the guy that's like, hey, no, we're unbelievable. You know what I mean? Like right. the Homer in me. And so in those moments, especially, it gets almost impossible to tell how realistic you're being, because yeah, just the party is on and somehow you've got Kobe down 20 and the place right. is going ballistic, and you know, Russ is making everything, and you know, Durant's flying down the court in transition and hitting these above the break threes that look like layups to him. Yeah, it was just a lot of wonder, right? Like you're just like, I can't believe how good they look. And then you start to be like, huh, I wonder what this could look like in the future. That's a terribly long answer. I apologize.
It first off, this is not like we're not chopping every one of these for TikTok. Like it's totally okay. But the other part, like that, but that's exactly, it's why I wanted to go back and kind of trace where we came from, because I think that, you know, the points that you made there, like, I thought we were further away and like, I wonder where this can go from here. You are back there. Like we are back at that place with Oklahoma City Thunder basketball. And, you know, there was the interregnum there of like, oh, Ibaka becomes Oladipo and Domantas Sabonis and they become Paul friggin' George and right. like Carmelo comes to town. They keep making the playoffs even after everything kind of shifts and it becomes more malleable there, and the KD and the Russ of it all and all those sorts of things. But like the remaining competitive for several years and then briefly like a 2-year dip into tankdom brings you now back to this place where, as we enter, you know, we're talking on Tuesday afternoon here on the East Coast, and like they are 27-12. They're a game back of the Wolves, tied with the Nuggets for second place in the West. You know, coming off a loss to the Lakers, and you got a date with the Clippers coming up. That's a pretty tough back to back, but like this is a team that can handle that kind of business. They've outscored opponents by 9.1 points per 100 possessions, according to Cleaning the Glass. Best net rating in the West, second only to the Celtics. Top five on both sides of the ball, like. This is, you are back in that kind of set of circumstances. And I think the big piece of that, as we sort of transition a little bit to this year's team, is Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. You know, and you know, we mentioned that, like the Paul George, all of these pieces, and then, you know, one red paperclip becomes a house. Serge Ibaka down the line becomes Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. And he is now like top three, top four MVP candidate, around 31-6-6 a game, that's shooting crazy. 56% from the floor. Yeah, everything I say makes me want to laugh more. And I'm wondering, what is your, and I know you had written a wonderful piece about him making the leap at the Ringer a little while back. And then it seems like he's just sort of kept making leaps, like how Mario can keep jumping in the air. what is your favorite thing about watching Shai Gilgeous-Alexander?
What a good question. Man, that's hard. I think it's the off balance stuff, or the stuff that looks like it should be off balance, but somehow he's not. You know what I mean? More like the like below the rim acrobatics, the on the ground acrobatics that he's able to wiggle and manipulate, not just through the whole defense, but also like in these tight isolation situations when there's been more and more times recently where it looks like a defender's kind of got him dead to rights, like where he's maybe picked up his dribble in the post or something like that. And just through lift fakes and pivots and shimmies, he finds daylight and he's strong enough now he can finish through contact. So it's kind of made him all the more exciting down there around the rim because the pot, I mean, he had like six and ones the other night against the Magic. It's something crazy. Ridiculous. Like he got Jalen Suggs in the air on one in the mid post after a couple lifts. And you could tell Suggs was just furious with himself for falling for the lift. But it was one of those, like, you feel so bad for Suggs. You see more and more like, he's getting like the top flight defender every night. And these guys are putting together good possessions. They're doing everything they can, strong contests, right? Like even when they're not letting him get a straight line drive on him and they're keeping him in front of him and getting him to a step back and getting, you know, a hand up. It's just, I mean, he's up to 35% on his threes now. That's been a bit of an upswing, but he also kind of doesn't need to take them.
Yeah.
And that's like that he can get 30 so easily, really, with the three as like an afterthought is just like wild. I mean, I guess that would be my answer. Like the off balance, on balance kind of acrobatics are the reason that because he's one of those guys that you think you can watch and kind of see a finish that maybe you haven't seen before. And those are the types of players that I love to see because they just crack your brain open and make you realize like that other things are possible. You know what I mean?
Well, it feels like he's dancing to a song that you've never heard a beat like that before, right?
Yeah,
and you're
like,
who are these guys? They're the Neptunes. And you're like, oh, what the like what the hell is that?
I want to listen to all their stuff. What, can I listen to all of it? Yeah.
Right. Yes. That sounds like it's from outer space. and like I don't often go to the numbers hardcore here because it's more about feelings than numbers, but you mentioned the isolation. He's shooting 57% on two-pointers when he ISOs somebody.
He's like what Chris Paul has been in the mid-range all these years. Like he's kind of turned into that. Just it's nails. Yeah. I mean, if he gets down there and lets it go, you feel really, really good about it. And it doesn't really matter the situation. I mean, just like all of his in-between work, like his stuff from like 11 to 16 feet, like all that whole area is just nasty, nasty at this point. Like he really, you feel like he's got full command of whatever he wants to do, especially now that the Thunder are a good shooting team for the first time in what feels like ever, right? Like right. Forever. Like that they're actually able to put all this shooting around him and give him this space and give him this room to operate. It's just like, That's part of the thing was like you talk about how he, like I wrote that thing that said he was making the leap, but he keeps doing it. Like it feels like really from jump straight, like from when he first got to Kentucky, it's just been constantly people kind of underrating what he can be. And then he makes a leap and people kind of readjust and they say, okay, he's going to be this now. And then he makes another leap and then people readjust. And then he's become a player who it makes me feel like I'm doing him a disservice if I like put any ceiling on, you know, like what he's right. going to be, like, you know what I mean? Like for all I know in 2 years, he's going to be shooting 40% from three on like high volume or whatever, you know, like, I don't know. He just keeps getting better that the defense has gone up a level in the way that it has this year. And that, cause I think it would have been easy for him to kind of let his foot off the gas on that end of the floor, especially with the addition of Chet. Jalen Williams taking a step forward and being able to guard people. Like it wouldn't have surprised me to see him be like, okay, I can conserve some energy down here. They can hide me on some guys and I can just kind of take some possessions off. And he doesn't do that. That he's taken a leap there and is using his energy on that end too. And can actually like affect some change down there has really like, sort of also changed where he could end up in my head.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You point to like, you don't want to put an artificial ceiling on it, because every time you do it or you put a governor on it, it's like, no, he blasts right through that. Even me saying like he is at worst a top three or four MVP candidate, I'm like, is that too, you know, like now, you know, like here be monsters out in the world. So you got to be careful, like saying, you know, that would put him any higher. He goes above Jokic and Embiid and Giannis, but also like, I don't, you know, talk to me in a month. I don't know. We'll see. But you mentioned also that he is operating in space unlike he has gotten before and all like unlike any Thunder team has had before. I want to talk to you a minute about Chet Holmgren.
Yeah.
Because I've talked about this on this show before and written about it. We've sort of batted it around a bunch. The idea that last year's Thunder was sort of like a team that had a big hole in the middle of it. Like you knew exactly what the piece was that needed to go there. And it was like, well, they're the things that are not great about it. We know what goes in there to fix it.
Right.
And then Chet Holmgren plays this year after missing all last season with the foot injury. And the degree to which he absolutely fixed all of those things and filled that hole so perfectly is almost ludicrous. And a piece that's going to be out today, maybe already up by the time this goes out, I wrote about like potential first time All-Stars. Yeah. I think there's a real chance he makes the All-Star team this year. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, what it's been like to watch him, you know, hit the ground, not even, I don't know, sprinting, you know, to go midstream and to be the piece that like, exactly what they've sort of were looking for. What is it like watching him sort of hit the ground running like that?
Oh, I mean, he's exceeded every expectation, I think, for what he could be this year, especially. I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of like watching the games last year and thinking theoretically this guy is the perfect puzzle piece and fits seamlessly and just we hit the ground running. And it's so weird that that's exactly what happened.
Yeah, we're so wrong, so rarely right about this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, and it's also like, it felt like the type of thing where it's like, yes, he is that, but in 3 or 4 years, you know what I mean?
Yes,
like,
right.
like, yes, he fixes these things long-term, but he's not going to be so good at fixing them right off the bat that it looks really good from jump, that he's been so effective already on both ends of the floor. Like he's going to get bodied. He's going to get muscled. Guys are going to catch him at the rim for sure. He's going to catch his fair share of guys too. And like, that's going to happen because he's a lunatic and he jumps for everything.
Yeah.
And he's just this hard playing dude who's got a lot of length and is unafraid of getting put on a poster, and it just causes a lot of fireworks. I mean, Anthony Davis caught him last night in a big way against the Lakers, but then he'll go up and, you know, the one that's coming in my head right now was against against the Knicks the other night. Hartenstein tried to catch him. I mean, Randall got him at the very, very end of the game whenever it was like one of the last possessions and the Thunder were up 11 or something like that. But he went up and got Hartenstein with two hands at the rim. And he's done that to a lot of guys. The combination of, oh, the 3-point shot is just kind of real right away, that he's that and can protect the rim and can also attack off the bounce in a way that doesn't mess with the flow of the offense.
Right.
That he can join in on the driving and the cutting. I mean, he's actually a pretty good cutter. He just knows how to play basketball. He knows where to be. I think you see sometimes these teams try to turn these centers that can shoot into like a guy that can kind of play five out and have the ball in his hand and make decisions and cut and hit guys on the move. And it's like, well, no, they can't do all those other things. They can shoot. And Chet's got a lot of different tools. You know what I mean? He's the stuff that he does well is the stuff that the Thunder offense rewards, if that makes sense. Like the way that Daigneault has built out that system of just constant drives and cuts and kicks and find space. Okay, like, you know, we've got a side of the floor cleared for y'all. Y'all do a little two-man game here, like all that stuff, inverted pick and rolls, guard screening for the bigs, whatever. Like he is comfortable in a lot of different spaces on the floor, doing a lot of different actions, right? And so he has been able to be a plus in so many different categories, and you can't really pick on him in any one way, has been the biggest surprise. I didn't think the off the bounce stuff was going to be like this at all at this point. You know, like you could see the whispers of it and stuff, but even in some of the summer league, among plenty of, you know, happy, positive flashes, sometimes he'd get a little wide with the handle. Guards could kind of get inside of it and poke it out and stuff. You felt like, okay, like it's going to take him a minute to adjust to the speed and figure out like how low he's got to be. You know what I mean? And it just seems like he's figured that out. I think it's helped playing in all that space has helped him too. Some of those, like, you know, drives rights, that these like kind of wide spins back to the middle, you know, yeah, what I mean? Like maybe those lead to more turnovers if he's not playing with a team that's shooting as well as the Thunder are right now. But it's, yeah, he's been so effective on both ends has been, it's just more than any Thunder fan I think could have asked for, honestly.
Well, yeah, you know, you mentioned all of the things he can already do so well, and you know, the Oklahoma City is familiar with watching a 7-foot string bean who can handle and pull up and do a lot of things. Like, no one is, you know what, here I am about to put artificial governors on stuff. It would be an awful lot to ask, you know, Dianu, if he become, you know, he gets to Kevin Durant. I'm not saying that.
No, 1,000%. Yes.
But to see that level of skill and versatility and the options that it opens up for you on both ends of the floor, but yeah, especially where, you know, all of a sudden you can have somebody that walks into 18 a night without necessarily needing to have a whole lot run for him. It does allow you to kind of wish cast and start dreaming big a little bit and wonder, you know, if the version of Chet we are seeing today is the one that we thought maybe we would see in a few years, then what is the version of Chet we see in a few years?
The Thunder themselves, but Chet in particular, you see him take so many, he gets so many wide open threes, mm-hmm, because of how worried defenses are about Shea. And now Jalen Williams is really starting to turn a corner here lately as like a guy who can be a primary too. He's getting to play in so much space now that he's able to be as smart of a player as he is. You know what I mean? Like he's not, you never watch Chet and feel like he's really all that rushed. And I think part of that is just, he's, you know, a good player and those guys tend to play at their own pace, but it's also because of how solidified everything is around him. He's getting to pick on some defenses in rotation and things like that. You know what I mean? And that doesn't feel like a thing that's going to go away. All this stuff feels so duplicable. You don't watch it and think he's like playing over his head or that things are just sort of set up in such a way offensively where like, okay, it's just working out that the shots are going to him right now. You know what I mean? Like he's able to do so much. It feels like that even as developed as he already is, it does still feel very early and like you're just scratching the surface of what it can be, just because, I mean, you're seeing them start to figure out different counters for things even already. Like you're seeing more like the lob chemistry between Jalen and Williams and Chet has gotten exponentially better even in the course of the last like 2 weeks. You know what I mean? Like it just, they're still learning each other and figuring out like how Chet's skill set fits around theirs. You know what I mean? Cause it's still, it's, you know, we're not even, what are we even 40 games into the season at this point? Barely. And so it's like, I keep trying to remind myself, especially with Chet, that it's still so early.
Right.
And it's and even though I'm totally with you, like I think an all-star nod is entirely plausible and not at all insane to discuss. But it is one of those things where I do have to keep like getting it in my head. Hey, this is like the very, very beginning of this. And it both makes me get very all the more excited and also just sort of like, okay, like let's just relax and try to enjoy this. You know what I mean? It's a fun place to be in as a fan right now.
Right. Yeah. We've talked about it a few times on the show, that idea that from my friend Paul Flannery used to say, like, the best time you can have in this league is right before you get really good. But now we're also like, you are really good and still having it. Just like, maybe even the best time. I don't know. But to that point, you know, you say like, it's still so early. And I know that's the thing that Presti said before the preseason press conference, like, we haven't even, you know, let us finish our breakfast before we figure out kind of where we go next. Which I hope that he got that from Jay. Like, I hope that's where he took that from. My homie Strick told me, dude, finish your breakfast. But
I mean, as a guy who has quoted Tribe in many a in big press conferences and big television specials, it's totally plausible. And maybe it was. You should ask him that. Maybe you'd actually get a response from them if you.
Yeah. You know who everybody's looking to field press requests from is me about this. But in any event,
quick Jay-Z question for Sam.
Yeah, right. I'm on deadline, so if he can get back to me like right now, that'd be incredible. Thank you so much. But you know, we're saying all these incredible things about the individual talent they've got. I'm really glad you brought up Jalen Williams, because he was somebody that if I had a little more time and a little more space and a little more opportunity, I probably would have put him in. It's like, you could argue for he's at least someone to think about on your long list as a first time all-star with the way he's been playing. But in addition to just being a top five team on both sides of the ball, being, you know, vying for first place, all those sorts of things. This is, I checked the number with Basketball Reference, by average age on the roster, this is the youngest team in the NBA, average age 23.1 years old. Yeah. Right in that Kobe White breakout sweet spot. and they have, I counted it earlier, if I have might have counted wrong, but I believe as many as 15, control over as many as 15 first round picks between now and 2030, even more second round picks than that, literally more assets than a team could use. So,
sure,
you know, what do you get for the man who has everything? You know, what would you even want to add to this team at this stage?
That seems to be the big question right now. I think they need more. I wouldn't want to bring in, unless it was just there are obviously exceptions to everything I'm about to say, but I would hesitate to bring in anybody who messed too much with the shot distribution hierarchy. They're already trying to like figure out how to make sure that Shea, Jalen Williams, and Chet are the three guys taking the most shots.
Right.
That's already something that is like, every now and again, Giddy's shooting way too much. Same thing with, I mean, Dort's been great this year. I mean, Giddy's been playing better lately. Dort's been shooting it well this year, but there's still times where it's like, you know, you look at certain games and you see that, you know, Giddy has taken 12 shots and Chet's taken 8, and it's like, yeah, that can't happen.
Yeah,
the days of that being all right are like at the beginning of the year, that wasn't okay. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, let's figure out a way to get our best guys the ball and to get our best guys shots. And so I hesitate to want to bring in somebody who is going to need 12 to 15 shots a game, if only because it's still so early with Chet and Jalen's development that I don't want to, if it's somebody who's going to have the ball in their hands a lot, I don't necessarily and again, exceptions galore, but I don't necessarily want to bring in somebody who's going to take the ball out of Jalen's hands right now. He's started to show a lot of healthy sauce in these late games.
I love that phrase. I love that phrase.
Like it is confidence and execution, like with a dash of how dare you think you could guard me? You know what I mean? Like it's like there's a good combination there that I think he's just going to keep blooming with the more opportunities that they give him, and as he takes more of the reins of that second unit, especially when Shea's off the floor, as it kind of becomes clear, like, all right, Giddey doesn't need to have. Let's move even more of his touches over here to Jalen. Let's get him and Chet in these pick and rolls and let them play in space and just let him be. I mean, Jalen's another guy who in the mid range has just become ice cold.
Yeah,
I mean,
monster.
It's I mean, everybody was talking after that great Celtics win the Thunder had. Everybody was talking about that final play he had where Shea goes and screens for him. And then he just takes Tatum off the bounce and gives Tatum a shoulder, and Tatum can't do anything with the physicality, which is insane to say that somebody like Tatum can't handle that in that moment. But it was no problem for Dub. And there's been a couple of times lately where they've just given him the ball and said, okay, you go shut the door. Like and they feel good about that. And so I get worried about bringing in somebody who might be trying to eat off his plate a little bit, if that makes sense. That said, they need another wing. Somebody bigger that can guard some people and can help on the boards. And then I would love if they went and got a big. My biggest thing with the other big is, you know, you hear people throw out like somebody like Claxton or something like that, who I think is a great player and like a quality big, depending on how the team wants to play.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Thunder play and the way that offense is at its best is when the ball is moving and when everybody out there is a threat to do something with it. And if you bring in a guy who is just going to kind of be a big and not be able to take people off the bounce, not be able to shoot, not be a threat with the ball, then I think that it negates a lot of what the Thunder do well. And I don't want to bring in somebody to lean on Jokic for 15 minutes if right. they're not going to be able, if we're not going to be able to get anything done offensively during that time. You know what I mean? And so somebody like a Kelly Olynyk or something like that, who can actually play with the ball in his hands and make some decisions and will be fine, like no matter how many minutes they get, you know what I mean? That seems kind of idyllic, you know, if the Wolves are tired of Naz Reid, would love to take him off their hands.
I think you got a better chance at Kelly. I think you got a better chance at Kelly than that one.
It feels like it. No, players in that kind of archetype, you know, I would rather see guys like that than somebody who's, you know, going to want to go into the post and get, you know, five touches or whatever during their stint. Like I'd more rather see some free flowing basketball.
I mean, you're seeing plenty of free flowing basketball with the Oklahoma City Thunder these days. It's an absolute joy to watch them. Let's figure out a way that we can get Kelly Olynyk and, I don't know, Dorian Finney-Smith or something. Let's get those guys over there.
That's a hot name.
Yeah, right. Like, you know, a bodyguard who's not going to talk too much. You know, yeah, let's get that guy over in the corner. That'd be tremendous for all of us. Wherever we go from here, I'm very excited to see where we go with the Thunder. But where we go from here on the show is we're going to wrap up with something called the Closing Five, Tyler Parker, because as I'm sure you know, you are a certified ball knower. How you start is not nearly as important as how you finish. Five questions for our special guest. Question the first. As I mentioned earlier, you wrote a novel titled A Little Blood and Dancing, published last summer. I've never written anything longer than a few thousand words, so that prospect absolutely terrifies me. What is the overriding emotion of putting something that big out in the world?
The overriding emotion, if I'm being honest, abject terror. But in there too, you know, at 49% is just like elation, right? Like there's relief in there. There's dumbfoundedness, you know, there's all sorts of different things mixed in, but yeah, totally terrified because it's the one thing. Well, not the one thing, but it's a thing that when you put it out, if people don't like it, there's nowhere else for the blame to go. You know what I mean?
Man.
And so you do in ways even different than just like writing a piece, you know, that goes up online. Like, you know, if there's some like kind of weird headline that gets people confused or something, and then gets them, you can like kind of say like, oh, well, that maybe that was. You can throw a little of the blame that way. This one is like if someone tags you on Twitter and is like, "Hey pal, swing and a miss," then you've got nowhere for that loss to go other than just right around your neck. You know what I mean? And so mixed in with just like, oh, I wrote that thing for 7 years and you're so worried it won't get bought, won't come out, come out, right? Like that all this has been for naught. And so that it did come out. I'm tickled, man. It's the book that I wanted to write. You know what I mean? And so it didn't get like bastardized in the editing process. I didn't have to like change shit about it that I liked. You know what I mean? Like it was what I wanted to write. And so I'm over the moon, you know, it's ultimately. Yeah.
I love both parts of that, because the first thing you said, where it's like, if someone doesn't like it, then there's no place for it to go but around your neck. Maybe I can identify with that as somebody who had to start a show with his name in the title that is just his face and his name and his voice and a whole bunch of things that where people are like, yes. Hey, what would you do? What makes this the most like the inside of your head? And I'm like, well, what if people hate that? It's a bummer. But then the second part of that is great, because like when someone says a nice thing about it, you're like, that person must get me. Like if they like totally. This, then they must get what the whole thing is.
Totally. And that's a great point. And the compliments that you do feel them more for something that is entirely you and that you've spent a lot of time on. Like I know how hard you work and how much you pay attention to the details and stuff. And so I'm sure that whenever someone compliments a specific aspect of the way that you're doing Divine Intervention, it like, you take it and it feels even better because you're seeing someone see and appreciate the way that you see things and the way, you know what I mean? Like the things that you notice.
Yeah.
And it's a very good feeling whenever something that you have really fussed over and thought was worth fussing over, when it is appreciated and complimented, like it, there is, on like a primal level, it's like, oh, that work was good for something. Okay, good. But it's just also like, yeah, it's like validation, right? It's like, okay, this worked. Let's try to keep going more towards this, right? Like, how can we be more this? You know what I mean? Yeah, I don't know. I'm all over the place with this answer.
That's completely okay, because it made me think of two things, and we'll get from this into question in a second. But that it makes me think of, I forget which football player it was, but it said like, you pay me for practicing the Sunday I do for free. Like every other day. Is the, so like when you say like whatever work goes into it and the structuring and the note cards on the wall and how we reorganize all of it, like that's what you're, and then like when the actual stuff goes on the page, and it comes out that way, and you're like, well, that's the way it is in my head. That's what, that I do for free. Oh, not for free. Pay people.
Feel free to cut this, because I know I'm not the one that's supposed to be asking the questions. But when you started your like this pod, and you were like, okay, I'm gonna have my own podcast, and you decide and it goes out, like, what was the feeling in your body whenever all that is happening? Because I know for me, I mean, even like in this, I think you comparing it to the book is perfect. And because it is like, oh, this is my thing. This, you know, like it's like what was going through your head whenever you've done all this work and you've got this format that you're happy with and it goes out like before, but I have a follow-up too, but when it goes out, because even me now, if like a piece of mine goes up, I'm like nervous.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like a little bit, like depending on what it's about or whatever, like you're a little bit like, man, I hope this is received. You don't like,
yeah,
you do want it to be received well, as gross and like desperate as that sounds. Like I can never get away from that. Like, oh man, I hope people like this one. You know what I mean?
No, 1,000%. And I feel like, so he's muted, so I can't hear him right now, but I have to imagine that super producer John Gennaro is like laughing his ass off at this question, because nobody has been more subject to my self-doubt and my uncertainty about all this and my like self-consciousness about all of it. When I left The Ringer and I came back to Yahoo Sports, and it was like, well, we're going to get sort of a podcast network up and running. The first thing I said was, I don't need to have my own thing. As long as I'm part of the conversation, I'm happy with it. I do not need to have my own thing. And then as the conversations kind of went on, I was like, well, what if you did have your own thing? I have been dragged to this place kicking and screaming because of my own anxiety over it, right? Like the idea that if they really get to know you, they will run. And so like, what is, because when, you know, it's like, what, how do we make this show like the way you think about things? And I'm like, no one could ever possibly give a shit about the way I think about things. It's like, actually maybe they would if you actually presented it that way. And so I have been trying to act as if I'm the person that these people have allegedly maybe want to hear from, and make the show that like, I'm going to be try to be the confident person that they think they want to hear. And, you know, we're 3 or 4 months into it and we'll see. I don't know. But
I think it's gangbusters. I'm asking you this from a place of, I know the show is going really well and that like, you're super
likable.
Bless your
heart for that.
Well, I mean, I just know that you're super likable and know what the hell you're talking about and are fun to listen to. Like that's all I need to know. No, you know what I mean? But like,
well, now I'm glad we're cutting all this out. That's great.
when it did go out and then people started to respond with like, hell yes, this is great. Doesn't that like really get you going? Like, doesn't that feel just so good?
It is. And I, this is, you know, maybe too much in my own brain, but like, it is relentlessly surprising when that happens. I'm like, are you sure? Right. And you have to just sort of like, you know, the extend to yourself the kindness you would extend to all those other people, that you would compliment their work and you would say like, yeah, I've enjoyed the things that you write, the things that you say, the things that you make. Allow for the possibility that that could also be true the other way around, right? That it could be a two-way traffic. And so yes, but yeah, it feels incredible, which is why, you know, you do all the other stuff to prep for it and get ready for it. So, but now we're not going to waste the rest of that prep. Question the second. You have tweeted on multiple occasions about the Liv Moss lifestyle.
Yes.
You identified Cam Thomas as embodying the Liv Moss lifestyle, and you recently identified a number of other players who do as well, including the aforementioned Coby White and Simone Fontecchio. A three-word question about the Liv Moss lifestyle. Why not Russ?
You know, I've thought about this. This is I thought about Russ, including Russ on that in the addendum, and I think at different points he does reach the Liv Moss lifestyle. I think that he is sometimes at this point in his career, there is still a little bit too much helter skelterness out there, and in order to Liv Moss, it's fine if I don't know what's about to happen, but I don't want to be too scared about the possibilities. You know what I mean? Like I like surprise, but I don't want a surprise that could turn into like a real deal, like the buildings are collapsing disaster. Right. And I love Russ, as you know, but there's maybe just a little bit too much rage in there at different points for me to fully get him into the Liv Moss lifestyle family.
An addendum sub question to this, because why not? Let's make this segment as long as humanly possible. It was something I meant to bring up earlier, but I didn't get to it. KD leaves and goes to the Warriors. And yeah, obviously that had its own level of anxiety and Sturm and Drang and everything with that. It does allow for unfettered Russell Westbrook, which gives you the triple doubles and the MVP and everything like that. If you had to pick one or the other, one, KD sticks around, but you never get maximalist Russ. Two, right, it unfolds the way it has. You know, is it a, you know, devil you know, devil you don't? Like, where does your fandom meter lead you on that?
Boy, what a heater from you here. This is good. This is, I think, boy, the unfettered Russ was just, it was one of those things where like early on you're like, man, could this work? And then very quickly, you're in the very, very back of your mind, you're like, I don't think this can work, but I'm not going to admit it yet. This is too, this is making me feel too much. I don't want to try to put any sort of reality into this. I just want to live in the clouds for a second. But I think I would stick with Durant staying, if only because I think it would have probably led to a title, probably.
Right.
And that's what we're here for.
Sorry. It's what the organization is here for. It's what all the executives are here for. And right, yes, to some degree, I will never undercut fans' search for joy being like a championship is the pinnacle and the apotheosis of all that.
Right.
But what we are here for is the feelings you just talked about.
That's true. That's a good point. I think in my head, a title would have given me more good feelings, sure, I think, than pure unfiltered Russ. I will say that there were times during that MVP season, and then even in the following one, where when he would go on a run, you would sort of feel like, well, I'm not sure if this can be any more fun. You know what I mean? Like right, when he was, because there was a force of nature element with Prime Russ, where he could like, it just felt like he could like bend the whole court to the point that it would just snap. You know what I mean? And like everyone is just like tumbling into like fiery earth, and for some reason he's not. You know, right, and like there was a level of like spectacle with him that is hard for one dude to be able to achieve. And he would do it semi-regularly and sometimes for bad reasons, but there was always some part of you with him where you were like, maybe he's why I gravitate to players like this, or I don't know what's the chicken and what's the egg. Right.
Sure.
But it's like I like guys who, when I'm watching them, I think in the back of my head, there's a possibility that they'll do something that I haven't seen and will show me something new. And in a game that, even as much as it's evolved and as it gets, the NBA gets like more and more different by the day. Right. Like, yep, certainly some of the offense is a little bit more homogenized than maybe the I'd like a little bit more of a grab bag, but like whatever. It's still changing by the day. And so there are these guys that can get to a place where you're seeing them actually break some ground still, even, you know, in a league that's like filled with guys that were better than him. If like going back to the Russ experience, like LeBron was better, Durant was better, Harden was better. Plenty of other dudes were better team basketball players than him, for sure. And even just individual basketball players than him. But there was something about him where you were like, yeah, but Russ might make me see God tonight.
Exactly right.
I hear what you're saying. Kawhi is wildly efficient. And yes, around 17 feet, if he can get to his spot, like, yes, it's curtains. But I don't think Kawhi is going to, like, make me trip. And and Russ is, there's always that threat with him where it's like, I might see a color I've never seen before.
Right.
And so holding out hope for guys like that, well, I'll always do that, if only because it's like Kobe White, going back to him, like, when you see some of the like dribble combos that he tries in these tight spaces, if he keeps getting this green light, he might do one of these like Steph against the Clippers, like weird figure eight, two between the legs crossovers into a back to back between two guys into a four, like a 25 footer, like that might be in his future. And so those sorts of dudes are always going to get my blood pumping a little bit more than other guys. All that said, supposedly if Durant came, Al Horford was going to come. And if we had had Horford, Durant and Russ,
yeah,
then I feel pretty good. You know what I mean? But we're also going to have to go through the Warriors again that next year. And, you know, who knows how the Cavs are looking at that point, you know,
the counterfactual is difficult to then reproduce. I understand.
There's no guarantees either direction with the stuff, but I would have loved to have seen what they would, because part of the thing with those late period Thunder teams was there were like a lot of injuries, obviously, like at crucial points in some of those postseason runs and things, but there were also just injuries like during the seasons. And so there wasn't like a, you know, Ibaka would be dinged up every now and again, right? And, you know, Durant and Russ might take turns being out for some games. Like you wanted to see them have another season where everybody's healthy and they can sort of, some of that continuity can start to pay off. Like they had continuity, but maybe not like where they needed it. You know what I mean? Like that's also wildly wishful thinking on my part. So, yeah.
Well, we get to engage in wishful thinking here, yes, as evidenced by the discussions of the Liv Moss lifestyle and Kobe White's dribble package. Question the third. Before you became a real professional basketball writer, you studied and performed improv comedy in Chicago, legendary Improv Olympic and Second City theaters. Who are some NBA players you think might make good scene partners?
Oh, my God, Dan. You're really coming with just gas today. This is fantastic. Good scene partners.
Well, what makes a good scene partner?
Happy to let their shit go. In like, always has ideas and is either coming with something good, but is also happy to let their shit go in the name of a better direction. You know what I mean? For the scene, I think. And I would say, you know who would probably be unbelievable at improv are the Lopez brothers. They would probably be frustratingly good, I think, at it. For like people that had been doing it for a long time, they'd like watch them and be like, well, why are they good already? What is that? You know, like, and the Lopez brothers would be good. I think that Anthony Edwards would probably be unbelievable at it. I think that Jordan Poole would either be the best improviser that you've ever seen or would tank shows at the drop of a hat. Like, I think he either comes on with the best bit you've ever heard or people get up and leave after he initiates.
I mean, it seems to be a replication of the experience we've had thus far in his career, where it's like, you're either Steph Jr. or you are maybe the least watchable player in the entire NBA. But maybe that's, it winds up being a certain level of watchability to that as well. You know, like, I cannot believe it's unfolding this way.
Yeah. Well, did you ever do improv?
No, never did.
Okay. But I know that, you know, that world a little, like, you know, I know you're like, no comedy.
I know a couple of the people through this stuff, like through basketball stuff, like Josh Gotcha. Gondelman was kind enough to be a guest on the show. Yeah. You know, the Ian Carmel and the All Fantasy Everything guys. But yeah, that's not something I've ever done.
Great dudes, love them both. Who's your answer? Do you have an answer for that question?
No, I love the Lopez brothers, because what I was thinking of, especially when you said, like, somebody who will bring ideas but is willing to get out of the way to make it all work, I'm like, it's somebody who is willing to box out and, like, make sure we, like, I wonder, you know, Steven Adams, I wonder if he's a little too taciturn and sort of dry for it, or like a little bit too, you know, but I love that idea. Sorry. Super producer John Gennaro just pops into the chat to scream Josh Hart, which is picking up on a bit from the pre-roll, but also very well could be. And somebody who
probably would be. He probably would be good.
Yeah, the natural dynamic that he and Jalen Brunson have as a comedy duo in the post-game pressers, I could see that working out really well.
And now, that just obviously just makes me start thinking about the Knicks, and then I think of OG, and then I think of What About Scarves, his moment with Serge from a few years ago. And that, I do think, is one of the funniest interactions that I've ever seen, like, committed to tape between two NBA players. I really think it's like, there are points in that, like, when Serge is saying, "Oh, geez, you told me about fashion." I think there are parts in that minute and a half long interaction that are just as good as any big budget comedy that we've seen in the last 25 years. So I do think that OG would probably be sneaky very good at it.
I love that answer. Question the fourth: how good is Trae Young, and how much does being from Oklahoma influence your answer to this question?
Good. Yes. So I think that Trey is, I think that, like, Trey's truth lies probably somewhere in between, like, there is, like, probably a certain type of casual basketball fan who knows him just through ads and highlights and, oh, he's a little guy who's had some success, and, like, look at these big shots that he takes and makes and these cool passes, and thinks he's probably better than he is. But then I think that some hardcore NBA fans, I think, probably get a little bit, maybe too hung up on the defense. Like, I agree that it's not good, and that it needs to be better if he ever wants to be on some title team. But I also think that it's a thing that keeps people from being able to put as much respect on his game as it deserves, if that makes sense. Like, I think that if he was just a chucker and didn't involve other dudes at all, and I get that these are, like, oftentimes, like, he's the only one that's touched it, and then the assist is right before
yes.
You know, I get that he's not letting everybody share the ball, but I also think that just as a pure passer, he's top five. I'm not ready for to go with to do any rankings of any kind, but, like, the stuff that he can do.
I'm sure,
like,
they'll have you rank these at the Ringer at some point. Ranking's kind of a big part of the operation.
It seems to be.
Which, hey, I was part of plenty of them. That's not a shot at the company. I was there, right? And I was in the mines too, man.
No, I get it. And it's also like, it just, there's a lot of places have a lot of rankings. It
yes,
seems
1,000%. But he's certainly up there in that realm of, like, the elite create something at a nothing level of passer.
I think specifically as a live dribble with either hand, mm-hmm. hitting guys that are a lot of times, like, cross court in the corner, two and three passes away, and, like, passes that are on a rope and that are right where the guy needs it to be. Like, these are, like, in the pocket passes. I think it's just, it's that those are really, really hard passes to make. And I think that when he gets discounted as just kind of like a shoot happy guy who doesn't play winning basketball, it doesn't take into account the skill that he shows sort of across the board on that end of the floor, because I don't think he's just a losing player. I think in the right context and hidden in the right ways defensively, like, I think it could work on a team that wins some things. And so how much does the me being from Oklahoma have to do with this? Probably a little bit. But you know what's funny about Trey is, like, everybody was so, all the OU fans. I'm a Oklahoma Sooner fan, and all the OU fans I knew, whenever he signed, it was just like, this is great, like, hometown boy, like, came home, this is awesome. And OU themselves started off so hot that year, like, they went. Early in the season, they went up when, like, Wichita State was ranked like second and just beat the brakes off of them. And, you know, like, they really, really looked good for the early part of the year. Then I think Trey got a little bit too big for his britches and things just kind of devolved from there. It got to the point where they almost didn't even make the tournament. They do. They get beat the first round, and a real slog in the second half of the year. And it seemed like he probably wasn't too fun to play with at different points. You know what I mean? Like, he still has some stuff that he's got to work out in terms of, like, his own malleability and being a guy that is fun to play with and that you want to play with, like, beyond just getting some cool passes from him every now and again. You know what I mean? Like, and so I'm not ready to, you know, call him like a perennial bad numbers or good numbers, bad team guy or anything right. like that. Because I think, like, I see too much from him offensively to give up when he's still this young. And when it does feel like he's only going to get smarter, you know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. He's very competitive it seems like he does want to win. You know, it's not like he doesn't seem content with just the numbers. So that's my long-winded answer. But there's definitely more than a dash of Homer in there for sure.
That's okay. The phrase that I'm having in my brain is like humanist Homerism. I don't even know exactly how we define it, but we're going to move toward a definition of humanist Homerism on this show. I think that you're right to be maybe higher than some of the, you know, basketball consensus on Trae Young. Like, then again, I watched him dismantle the Knicks and dismantle the Sixers defense and dismantle the Bucks defense until he got hurt in that series, and was like, a guy who can do that at all three levels in a playoff series against wildly different defenses, there's something to hang on to there. So yeah, I'm with you.
I think sometimes these like guards that are good numbers, bad team guys, when they do get into the playoffs, they show some level of fear, right? Like, they're not ready for the moment.
And
they,
man,
like,
when did he when, not?
Yeah. And so I think that there's something. Like, that's a skill too. You know what I mean? And so I have a hard time totally selling on him because of that, but that might be stupid of me.
Well, we can be stupid in a safe place on this show. Question the fifth, talking about being stupid. We talked about free-flowing offense before, but right now we're going to slow it down. We're going to clear out one side of the floor. I'm going to enter you the ball on the block, and I want you to go to work. Talk to me about Alexei Pokuševski.
Oh. Man, my sweet boy, my sweet sad boy. I had so much hope for him near the end of last year because he got. Boy, I've had a lot of sleeps since he's been effective. Man, this is sad. A lot of sleeps. He had a run before he got hurt, where when you watched him, it sort of made sense finally. It wasn't going to be like taking the top off the ceiling for the team or anything like that, but you could see like a guy who could dribble it a little bit, shoot it a little bit in the right circumstance, pass, who could
had more than one thing he could do on offense. You could sort of see how it would work. And weirdly, he was like a good, like a great help defender at the rim. Like he was way more sturdy down there than you kind of imagined he would be. And then I mean, he gets hurt, and I think he's just been victim of, like, the team just got really good really fast.
Yeah.
And less likely to be experimental with some of these minutes. I mean, Daigneault is still going to – Daigneault's a wild man, and you won't – the moment that anybody thinks they can get a handle on rotations and things like that, he's going to change stuff up again just in the name of tinkering and trying to figure stuff out. And I like that he does that for the most part. There's some times where it's like, last night Aaron Wiggins didn't – I don't think he got a minute, and that's a game where Aaron Wiggins probably should have played. Mm-hmm. Like, Lakers are running tons and tons of zone. You need somebody who's a good cutter who can shoot a little bit. Like, it just would have made sense for him to play in that game. They were giving Jing some minutes, after a little extended G League stint. So I think they were kind of trying to see, like, okay, like, let's get you some run here and see how you're looking.
Oh, no, Tyler, the double team's coming in the post. Last thought on Poku.
Oh, no. I think that he's not going to be on the Thunder for very much longer, but I want so badly for him to catch on somewhere.
I love that.
Thank you for stopping me.
It's all right. No, every once in a while, we got to heat up the post. But
yes.
Reminder, he's 22 years old. We started this conversation with Kobe White needing some time. I hold out a hope in our heart for Alexei Pokuševski. Maybe we, in a year, we're having the same kind of conversation about him getting an opportunity. Before we get for a year down the line, the last thing we do on Divine Intervention is a weekly recommendation. Does not have to be about basketball. Does not have to be about anything we've been talking about. Just something that is good and cool you like and think other people might like. Tyler Parker, do you have a recommendation?
Yes, I do. This is the one thing that I forgot to think about. Dan, I'm so sorry. What could be my recommendation?
If you would like to take a minute, I can go first.
You go first, please. That would be great. All right. Thank you so much.
No problem. You mentioned earlier, we talked about comedy, your comedy background, and just like some of the people we've gotten to know in that world through this thing. One of them that I know is Jesse David Fox, who is a culture editor at Vulture Magazine, a comedy critic there. He wrote a book called Comedy Book that is about how comedy conquered culture and the magic that makes the comedy work. And it's sort of like it is something. The goal of the book is to elevate discussion of comedy, stand-up, improv, movies, sketch, whatever, to treat it like a real art form. It's something like to apply the principles of criticism to comedy. And like, I know there's the general idea of the more you inspect or poke at, it's like poking the dead frog, right? That's the idea. Like the more you dissect comedy, the deader it gets and the less funny, fewer laughs there are in that. But if it's something that matters to people, and I like the idea of being able to take it seriously and to think about it and why it works and what parts of it work and what parts of it don't work and that kind of stuff. Jesse does that about as well as anybody that I am aware of. And the book is a fantastic read. I'm almost finished with it. Right after that, I get to a little Blood and Dancing. But I heartily recommend if you are somebody who likes comedy of any kind and likes thinking about it, Jesse David Fox's book, Comedy Book, available wherever you get books. So that'd be my recommendation for this week.
Good call. That's very good. And I've been wanting to read that book. And I think I follow Jesse on Twitter. Mine will be in a similar vein. There's this comedian, Gary Gulman, who just came out with his newest special. It's called Born on Third Base. He also came out with a book, which I'm wanting to read, called Misfit, which is about kind of his adolescence and growing up. In Boston. But the thing that I've seen is his newest special, and it's very, very good. And he's a comedian that really pays attention to the words and has spent a lot of time clearly like crafting these bits and putting bows on them and really like making it a Swiss watch with the way that everything works with everything else that's in the set. And his special before this I've been a fan of his since his special before this, which was called The Great Depression, which is on HBO. And unbelievable that I'm not remembering this guy's name. Judd Apatow directed it. And
you know that guy.
What was funny is, like, because Judd Apatow wrote that book that was maybe called something A Dead Frog. And so I thought of it, whenever you said that, I think there's a bunch of his conversations with comedians. But anyways, Goldman like sort of got institutionalized and was like really dealing with like clinical hardcore depression. And the special is about him getting out of it and his experience with it. It's also about his mom a little bit, who's kind of a piece of work. And so just Goldman's comedy across the board, I think he's like one of the best guys doing it right now.
Absolutely.
And I don't care about it, but if people do care about it, he doesn't ever really curse that much, that's usually a deterrent for me. I usually think that it's kind of a crutch. Whenever you hear that about a comedian, especially if that's one of the first things I hear, then I get very, very worried about its quality. You know what I mean? It's kind of like whenever someone's like trying to say that a guy is going to make it to the Hall of Fame and they bring up his Olympic stuff. You know what I mean? You know, you're kind of like, I don't know, leave that further down. Don't let that be one of the first ones.
Yeah. That shouldn't be in the lead. That should be four or five paragraphs down.
Yeah. But Goldman, if you have people that won't listen to stuff unless it's clean, he's like the ideal for that. You know, Bergazzi's good too. Mm-hmm. Goldman's really got some high quality shit.
It's whatever gets them into the church, right? And then it's about, you know, the sermon that comes after that. But I love that phenomenal recommendation, phenomenal appearance on Divine Intervention for Tyler Parker. We're also going to make sure we recommend one more time on the way out the door, A Little Blood and Dancing by Tyler Parker. The novel came out last year. Absolutely. I cannot wait to get into it. Tyler, if there's anything else that you want to make sure to make people aware of or plug on your way out the door, please do so now.
Nothing in particular. Got a couple things coming down the pike at the Ringer that'll probably hit late this month or early next, but nothing of consequence right now to say go click on that, you know.
Well, we'll keep our eyes peeled for that at theringer.com. What a great website. That is going to do it for us here on Divine Intervention. Thank you so much to Tyler Parker for taking all this time to be with us. Thanks to super producer John Gennaro for doing all the things that he does to make this show look and sound great. If you got a minute, wherever you're listening to or watching this, please go rate, review, subscribe. Rate us 5 stars, write a review, let people know about the show. It helps with discoverability and growing the show. So if you've enjoyed it, that would be really kind of you. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you again next week. Take care of yourself. You deserve it.